Welcome to Scientific American on Voice Corps. I'm your volunteer reader, Gina Pataka. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the June 2026 issue of Scientific American magazine. This week, I'll continue reading from the articles contained in the section entitled The New Moon Race. This next piece is entitled Eyes in the Sky, and it was written by Joseph Howlett. The Artemis moon missions are a game changer for astronomy. As the U.S. government slashes its spending on basic science, one thing seems certain. There's still plenty of money for going back to the moon. NASA's Artemis II mission is only the tip of the space agency's lunar exploration spear. Planning for crewed and robotic follow-ups is well underway, and all of these other trips could involve equipment for groundbreaking research, too. There's a lot to learn on the moon. Most of it is about the moon itself, its murky origins, its expansive history, and even the vital resources it might hold. But some astronomers, faced with increasingly austere government funding for their ground and space-based projects, are beginning to see the moon as a more stable stage for some of their most ambitious cosmic studies. Anze Slosar, a physicist at Brookhaven National Laboratory in New York State, had once hoped to put a radio telescope on the far side of the moon, but abandoned his dream years ago. The mission just seemed too expensive, and there wasn't enough interest in it. After the Apollo landings, the thinking was, we've done it, and that was that, he recalls. Sentiments changed during the first Trump administration. One day, Slosar got an email from a Department of Energy program director asking him whether he still thought building a far-side radio telescope was possible and whether he was interested in leading the DOE's involvement with such a project. It was the easiest choice of his professional career. I said, of course, he recalls. It changed my life forever. The reason for Slosar's enthusiasm is that a radio telescope on the moon could do things none on Earth can. Radio telescopes on the ground can collect signals from only a limited range of wavelengths. That's because as air molecules in the upper atmosphere soak up the sun's ultraviolet rays, they get so excited that they shed their electrons, becoming ionized. For most radio waves, the resulting ion-filled layer, the ionosphere, is like a giant mirror, blocking many inbound cosmic messengers. The solution isn't as simple as launching a radio telescope into space. To be of much use to radio astronomers, any spaceborne observatory would need to be exquisitely sensitive, so sensitive that its observations would be swamped by telecommunications emanating from Earth. To tune in to distant galaxies and other faraway objects, astronomers would need an antenna in a place with no atmosphere that would also be somehow protected from all our terrestrial chatter. Such a place exists, of course, and it's only a proverbial stone's throw from the third rock from the sun. Earth is locked in a synchronous dance with the moon, so the same lunar hemisphere always faces away from us. On that far side surface, the moon itself acts as a shield from Earth's cacophony of radio signals. This obstruction is exactly why Houston Ground Control lost contact with the Artemis II crew for about 40 minutes during the April 6 lunar flyby, when the mission's Orion spacecraft was masked by the moon. Behind the moon, at the right time, you can avoid interference from both the sun and the Earth, Slosar says. It becomes one of the quietest places in our solar system for observing these radio frequencies. That span of wavelengths happens to be a window into the most mysterious epoch of the universe's history. Our oldest snapshot of the universe comes from some 380,000 years after the Big Bang. It is known as the Cosmic Microwave Background, or CMB, and is made up of the light that was released when the hot, dense plasma that suffused the early universe cooled enough to form hydrogen atoms. Much like the radio-blocking swarms of electrons in Earth's ionosphere, unbonded electrons in that ancient ionized plasma blocked light, too. So when they all settled down into atomic hydrogen, light that had spent millennia hidden by the primordial fog was liberated to stream freely across the universe. Today, we see this last scattering surface as a diffuse all-sky radio glow. But we have essentially no data at all about the cosmos for hundreds of millions of years after that singular moment in time. That's because the universe was full of relatively cool, light-smothering hydrogen, which emitted scarcely any light of its own. Only when stars and galaxies started forming from all that hydrogen was there enough light and heat to reionize some of the hydrogen atoms, making those growing cosmic structures visible to our telescopes. There was a bit of light in the so-called cosmic dark ages, though. A faint trickle of 21-centimeter wavelength radio emissions emanating from the hydrogen atoms. Astronomers have managed to detect some 21-centimeter cosmic signals through heroic efforts using ground-based instruments, but the noisy, patchy view painted by these detections is woefully incomplete. To map the dark ages and all their hidden mystery, to discover how exactly cool matter coalesced into luminous cosmic structures, the best option by far is to search from the far side of the moon. That is where SLOSAR comes in. He now directs the DOE's contributions to the partnership with NASA on a project called the Lunar Surface Electromagnetics Experiment NIGHT, LUSEE NIGHT, which aims to launch to the lunar far side in December 2026. It will fly on board a Blue Ghost lander from Firefly Aerospace as part of NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services, CLPS, initiative, which relies on landers built and operated by private industry to deliver spacecraft, experiments, and other payloads to the moon's surface. Once LUSEE-NIGHT reaches its destination, its greatest challenge will be getting through the cryogenically cold lunar night, which lasts for the equivalent of about 14 Earth days. Pink Floyd might have misled you. The moon's far side isn't always dark. When it is, though, it's an inhospitable place. Few experiments have survived the night. Ultimately, the mission is meant to be a pathfinder, proof that even larger and grander radio telescopes can be built and operated on the moon's far side. A free trip to the moon would be a dream for the newest addition to the ranks of astronomers, those who study the universe by investigating gravitational waves. It was just 11 years ago when humans gained the ability to scan the skies for these elusive waves using the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, better known as LIGO, LIGO. This project uses lasers to sense the subtle stretching of space and time caused by the cataclysmic merging of two gigantic black holes. The European Space Agency's upcoming Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, LISA, L-I-S-A, mission, essentially LIGO in space, will expand on the revolution LIGO started. Launching as soon as 2035, LISA could send waves from mergers of black holes that are far more massive than those within LIGO's purview. It will also spot the slower ripples of calmly orbiting binaries, emitted long before their death spiral begins. Both of these sources make waves with millions of kilometers between peaks, too long for any Earth-based instrument to register. To complete their coverage of the gravitational wave spectrum, astronomers have their eyes on the Moon. The Laser Interferometer Lunar Antenna, LILA, would close the gap between LIGO and LISA by tuning in to waves with intermediate wavelengths. These signals would include those from the mergers of white dwarfs, the astronomical objects that produce many of the supernovae we observe through their electromagnetic emissions. LILA would also capture the gravitational waves from neutron star and black hole binaries just as they began their final descent toward coalescence, providing an early warning system that could alert LIGO to collisions 2 weeks before they happened. You're listening to Scientific American Magazine on VoiceCore. There is no other place in the solar system where you can detect gravitational views in this mid-band, says Karen Johnny, an astrophysicist at Vanderbilt University who is a principal investigator of the LILA project. There is only the Moon. That's because the Moon is much more geologically inert than our rowdy planet. It doesn't have as active a core, Johnny says, meaning the lunar surface can be a quiescent platform for gravitational wave spotting laser systems custom-made for the mid-band. LILA will essentially be built of mirrors mounted on rovers. The project team hopes to hitch a ride on an upcoming CLPS mission. When the lander opens onto the lunar surface, two rovers with mirrors will head in different directions, forming a triangle with 5-kilometer-long sides, with the lander as the triangle's third point. Then, an instrument on the lander will beam lasers outward to the rovers to compare their distances with subatomic precision. To be honest, we wouldn't be thinking about LILA if the United States were not going to the Moon, Johnny says. The LILA team is hoping to reach a later phase of the project that would be carried out in collaboration with NASA's Artemis program and rely on astronauts for operation and maintenance. Observatories such as the James Webb Space Telescope, JWST, and the Hubble Space Telescope, and for that matter, your typical consumer-grade reflector telescope, are all based on the same design. A mirror curved just so to channel incoming light from many directions onto a single focal plane. Large telescopes use segmented mirrors to collect more light from faraway objects and produce a crisper image. JWST's primary mirror is composed of 18 sections. Optical interferometry is a way to make a telescope's light-gathering surface far bigger by spreading out such segments over an even larger area. In this approach, individual mirrors are interlinked in an array, with each node channeling its light to a central facility that carefully corrects and combines these inputs, effectively forming a much more powerful telescope. By piggybacking on the Artemis program, NASA scientist Kenneth Carpenter aims to build an optical interferometry facility on the Moon. This proposed Artemis-enabled stellar imager, AESI, would consist of 15 to 30 rover-mounted mirrors, allowing for reconfiguration and other fine-tuning on the fly, so the imager could fix on any target in the lunar sky. Besides being a potent technological pathfinder, AESI could monitor many stars throughout a sizable swath of the Milky Way. By studying them in ultraviolet light that terrestrial observatories can't access because of Earth's UV-blocking ozone layer, the project could literally shed more light on the still mysterious details of stellar activity across the galaxy. "We have wonderfully high-resolution data on the Sun," Carpenter says, "but we still haven't come up with a good predictive model of future activity. Scientists' best solar models struggle to precisely predict flare-ups on our own most familiar star. But the hoped-for expansive stellar data sets that AESI could provide may help change that. The project could also benefit from astronautical interventions, Carpenter says, meaning AESI maintenance would be another possible task for the Artemis crew that NASA plans to land on the moon by 2028 and throughout the 2030s. If Carpenter's decades of experience working on the Hubble Space Telescope taught him one thing, it's that troubleshooting an experiment is infinitely more effective with a human on site. The space shuttle and Hubble were kind of designed with each other in mind, he says, pointing to the STS-61 mission in 1993, which included a spacewalk to fix a critical problem with Hubble's mirror. That historic telescope, Carpenter says, probably would have been a failure without the collaboration of the human spaceflight program. Next, I'd like to read some pieces from the advances section. The first one is under the heading of Planetary Science, and it's entitled Weird Worlds, and it's written by K.R. Calloway. This sulfurous hell world might change the way we classify exoplanets. Trillions of miles from Earth, a cluster of planets whirl around a sun of their own, and one of the worlds is a sulfur-swathed oddball. Research suggests that planet L98-59D would smell like rotten eggs and is covered in a mushy magma ocean. And it isn't just an outlier in its home solar system. So far, it's the first exoplanet found to fit this peculiar description, and it seems to be defining a category of its own. Scientists first observed the planet in 2019 when the Transiting Exoplanet Survey satellite caught a glimpse of L98-59D passing in front of the red dwarf star at the center of its system. Afterward, observations from the Hubble and James Webb Space Telescopes hinted at the planet's composition, but the more scientists learned, the less this newfound orb seemed to fit into existing categories for planets of its size. Neither rocky, with a thick hydrogen atmosphere, nor an ocean world, L98-59D might occupy a new class of molten sulfurous exoplanet, according to a study in Nature Astronomy. It's pretty hellish, it's pretty alien, says Harrison Nichols, lead author of the study and a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Cambridge. With more data, we might find that there are other planets like it too. The first confirmed detection of an exoplanet, though long anticipated, was only 34 years ago. Increasingly powerful telescopes have since launched the field forward with more detections, now more than 6,000 in total. But it's one thing to find an exoplanet and quite another to understand its surface conditions. Astronomers can gauge the size and mass of far-flung worlds by watching how light dims and wobbles as the planets cross in front of their home stars. They study planets' composition by measuring the light that passes through their foreign atmospheres. Theorists then bring these wide-ranging worlds to life through cohesive models of the planet's features and formation. Even with perfect data, the numbers don't tell you anything on their own, Nichols says, and we're limited a little by what we can be certain about with planet L98-59D. Scientists know that the planet is about 5 billion years old and that its searing surface temperature reaches more than 1,500 degrees Celsius. It's about 1.6 times the size of Earth, but it has an unusually low density. The strangest feature in the data, however, is its sulfur-rich atmosphere. Many young planets, including early Earth, have a brief rotten eggs phase because of intense volcanic activity, but the hydrogen sulfide sulfur dioxide produced in that period don't usually stick around for 5 billion years. Researchers used computer models to turn back the clock on L98-59D and figure out how it could have formed. They found that a disk of material around a star with enough of these volatile components could create a type of planet that's molten from its sticky surface all the way to its core, and that such planets might be common. You're listening to Scientific American Magazine on Voice Corps. In general, in science, we start by telling very simple stories, and those stories get more elaborate as time goes on because we have to explain a wider range of things or more detailed measurements, says Heather Knutson, a planetary scientist at the California Institute of Technology who was not involved in the new study. This is a great example of that. Because the field of exoplanet research is so new, there are not yet enough categories to adequately describe the diversity of these bodies. L9859D is a step toward moving beyond boxes of discrete planet types, such as ocean or rocky worlds, and establishing a continuum of types that might give insights into how worlds change and evolve, says Julian DeWitt, a planetary scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who also was not involved in the study. Really, the dream of an observer is to construct a classification scheme that then doesn't just describe the universe, it tells you something new about the universe, agrees Thomas Beatty, an astronomer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who was not part of the study. Perhaps the best example of such a classification system, Beatty says, is the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. This scatter plot of stars illuminated the process of stellar evolution and jump-started the field of stellar physics more than a century ago. That work started with simply observing individual stars and sorting them into categories, just like scientists finally have the technology to do with exoplanets today. Some hope that an exoplanet classification system will similarly help to resolve the unknowns in planetary evolution, such as how the process differs among planet types. Although studying weird worlds such as L98-59D will probably help to clarify how planets evolve, researchers are still working to understand this particular one. A molten magma world best fits the data collected so far, but scientists are observing the exoplanet to eliminate uncertainties, such as how much sulfur is in its atmosphere, that could pin down our understanding of what things are like on the surface of L98-59D. Researchers suggest that we should have an even clearer conception of the planet after another year or two of observation. By then, L98-59D may not be alone in its proposed new class. The field is moving so quickly, and we're learning there's so much we don't know, Nichols says. I do think that we have good reason to believe that the sulfur world is probably going to be quite a substantial category of planets. Next, under the heading of biology, we have a piece entitled Tiny Climbers, and this was written by Elizabeth Ann Brown. Zeti-sized fish scale a massive waterfall. The world cheered when Alex Honnold free-climbed a 101-story skyscraper in Taipei. Gather now, fickle public, to applaud the new free-climbing champion, the chelier, a fish that is about the size of a ziti noodle and that can scale a 50-foot waterfall. During major floods, thousands of the tiny fish convene at Luvilombo Falls in the Upper Congo River Basin to undertake a peculiar vertical migration described for the first time in scientific reports. At sunset, they sidle up to the splash zone, the damp areas on either side of the waterfall's main flow, and press their fins flat against the sheer rock face. The fins are covered in what study lead author Kiwele Mutambala Pacifique, a PhD student at the University of Lubumbashi in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, calls petit crochet, French for little hooks. These microscopic single-celled structures give the chelier its grip, he explains. Then, with a wiggle of the tail, it's as if the fish is swimming, but in vertical, he says. It's beyond imagination. How can such a little fish scale a vertical distance that is, proportionally to its size, 50% taller than Honnold's skyscraper. In this case, by taking a lot of breaks. The chaleur travel with bursts of upward motion that are peppered with short rests under a minute long and longer breaks of about an hour whenever they reach a ledge where they can lay their fishy head. The entire journey takes about 10 hours, and most of that is, in fact, resting time, says Emmanuel Vreven, an ichthyologist at the Royal Museum for Central Africa in Belgium, and a co-author of the new paper. Some of the fish fall down during climbing and have to start over again. Clearly, the chaleur are highly motivated to climb. Whether the journey helps the fish evade predators at the foot of the waterfall or pursue a mate or a meal upstream, scientists aren't certain. It's fabulous to see a fish use friction enhancers like these hooks to cling and climb, says Adam Summers, a biologist at the University of Washington who studies unusual adaptations in fish and wasn't involved in the study. Other species, such as lumpsuckers, Summers' longtime favorite, employ suction to stick to rocks. In fact, an April 1913 issue of Scientific American includes an article about a South American catfish that used suction in a similar way. But the friction trick most likely works for chaleur only because of their diminutive size. Indeed, the authors noticed that larger individuals get left behind at Luvilombo. The researchers hope the chaleur's athleticism will inspire ecotourism for African fauna. That's all for articles from Scientific American. Stay tuned for more programming on Voice Corps, your audio access to the world.